destination unknown. Double cross messenger, all alone. Can't get no connection, can't get through. Where are you?
I like American history. Welcome, everyone. Jim Selinsky here, Outdoor Talk Network, and thanks for joining us one more time. And I tell you, I got a terrific show for you. I really do. And I've often said, you know, this show is a thinking man show, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a little walk down memory lane. I've got a tremendous guest, Mr. Bob Zybach is his name, Z-Y-B-A-C-H. And I've known of Bob for quite some time. We're on the same mailing lists, you know, or email lists. And Bob is highly regarded, highly respected by Dr. Charles Kay and Mike Dubrasich and a lot of the people that we have interviewed over the years, and people who have emerged as you know, very truthful people in all of these debates. Bob is one of those guys, and I believe he's some sort of forest historian. And we're going to talk about, you know, this country before the Europeans came here and settled here, how the Native Americans were handling the land, how were they managing the forest, the trees, and you know, of course, the wildlife and so forth. What were they really doing? You know, contrary to what the environmentalists want us to believe and what they tell us, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And I've asked Bob Zybach to join us, and he is a good one, I assure you. So he'll be with us right after the break. But go to my site, OutdoorTalkNetwork.com. You know, of course, the stuff there for Bumper Dumper and Dow Chemical and the NRA, huntersrights.org and all that great stuff, that's all there. And I tell you, a pleasant surprise for you. I've been mentioning that I'm writing for magazines now, and I'm literally forced to take my camera with me and take some pictures. I went out with my son, and I'll put those pictures up. I'll have my webmaster put those pictures up. You will get the biggest kick out of it. We caught some nice fish, and I'm in my boots and my vest and just having a good old time. Really, I do love to fish, and I'll put them up for everybody to see. But we'll go to break. We'll come back. New station, WFBL, 1390 AM. They were with us years ago, and they went away for 18 months. They changed their format. They became a golden oldie station. Now they're a talk station, and they're back on. Syracuse, New York, WFBL, 1390 AM. Thanks for joining the network. So here we go, and love this Bruce stuff. Love this Bruce stuff. We'll have to see how this works out. Still don't understand a word he's saying, but stay with us. We'll be back. Bob Zybach is his name. See you in a few.
Well, I put my heart and soul there. I put a pipe on the shelf. You're right next to that thing.
Every so often, a product comes along that makes tremendous sense. Enter the Bumper Dumper, your portable sanitary potty that travels with you wherever you go. It easily attaches to your vehicle hitch receiver or stands alone with a 5-gallon bucket. Never again will you not know what to do when nature says you have to go. It comes with a standard toilet seat and just add the available clip-on toilet paper holder for that at-home feeling. It is ideal for camping, hunting, fishing, scouting, traveling, off-roading, wilderness areas, ranches, farms, and how about this one, tailgating. Go to www.bumperdumper.com and take a look. The ultimate portable toilet is super sanitary and makes a great gift for that outdoor fanatic in your family. Lightweight, easy to store, but it will hold 300 pounds. The Bumper Dumper is a must-have for the traveling family. That's www.bumperdumper.com. Of course, it is made in the USA. Not since the introduction of graphite in fishing rods has a product created the excitement of Temple Fork Outfitters' new line of fly rods. Designed primarily by Lefty Cray, TFO has a fly rod for everyone, regardless of your budget. Choose from the Lefty Cray Finesse series for clear water and delicate presentations, or the smooth and powerful Lefty Cray Signature series, or my personal favorite, the medium-fast Lefty Cray Professional series for great all-around performance. Deer Creek spay rods and switch rods are all part of TFO's line. For those who prefer fast-action rods, TFO offers their new TICR X rods and their patent-pending Kevlar sandwiched Axiom rods. Their beautiful Gimtini series of fast-action rods can throw sink tips with speed and accuracy. Go to their website at templeforkflyrods.com and check this out. How about the Lefty Cray Blue Water series for chasing marlin, tuna, and sailfish? Hook me up, please. All TFO rods come with a no-fault lifetime warranty.
Delfrost RVR Seasonal Freeze Protection Fluid is a ready-to-use solution that provides protection against bursting of potable water systems when exposed to freezing temperatures. It also contains proprietary corrosion inhibitors to help prevent rusting and corrosion of plumbing system components in seasonal equipment. Products like Dalfrost RVR are important for use in outdoor applications, especially when there's a possibility of drinking water contamination or a chance the product could be spilled near a lake or river. Made from plant-derived biorenewable resources, Dalfrost RVR is readily biodegradable and will break down if spilled on the ground or in the water without harming fish, reptiles, or mammals. It's also safe for use where accidental exposure to children or pets could occur. Dalfrost RVR Seasonal Freeze Protection is available now at Walmart, AutoZone, and other select retailers. For more information, visit www.dalfrostrvr.com. That's dalfrostrvr.com.
Got cooking. How's about cooking something up with me?
Hey. All right, I heard that song every Saturday morning for almost all of my childhood. Hank Williams Sr., my father's favorite, and that's what we played on Saturday morning. But my guest, Bob Zybak, and I don't know much about him. I know he's highly recommended, you know, by some great people and so forth. We're going to talk a little bit about forestry management, the development of the West, the lots of things. But, Bob, thank you for your time. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
No, you're highly recommended. Of course, we have a lot of the same friends. Mike Dupersich, he's been on a couple times, and his whole thing there and SOS, Save Our Forest, and so on. But let me give you the opportunity to tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing, you know, what your area is and so forth, and take it away, Bob.
Okay. Well, I'm 61 years old, a seventh generation Oregonian. My field of expertise is wildfire, catastrophic fire and Indian burning patterns, forest history. That's what I have my PhD in.
Oh, wow.
So I'm technically a historical ecologist, I guess. Before that, my previous lifetime, raising a family, and I ran a business for 25 years as a reforestation contractor, and our business did about 80,000 acres of reforestation work through the Pacific Northwest, broadcast burning, tree planting, pre-commercial thinning, that type of thing.
Oh, wow. No, that's impressive. And what'd you call yourself, some sort of forest ecologist or forest?
Historical ecologist. That's to separate me from the forest ecologist and the fire ecologist. Who I don't always agree with.
Okay.
Historical ecologist means that bipeds are part of the ecosystem and that they might even be the keystone species.
Okay. Now, what's a biped? What's that terminology?
That means a human being.
Okay.
The humans, we are the top of the food chain. We kill and eat and hunt what we want. We're omnivores. We make fire.
Okay. Bipeds is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yes, and okay. All right, so now I understand. And I just saw a show on this. I love that archaeology stuff on TV, you know, the History Channel and the you know, the bones they pick up and dig up every so often. And, that stuff is really gets me going. That and the astronomy stuff and the universe stuff, that stuff is hard to comprehend, some of those principles. So.
Well, I had to get basically a degree in archaeology. My master's degree qualifies me as an archaeologist in Oregon. I had to go to archaeology field school. And what I do is a type of archaeology, but I don't use lithics. I don't use stone like obsidian, spear points, and those types of things. I use vegetation patterns. So I'm looking at relic patterns left over from previous cultures, huckleberry patches, bear grass patches, oak savanna, filbert groves, those types of things.
All right. Now you are on the same mailing list as Dr. Charles Kay, correct?
Yep.
You know him, and he writes.
Yep.
Of course, he's a big hunter, but he's also is he an archaeologist? What is his specialty? He's been on twice, and he just amazes me the stuff that he comes up with.
Charles and I have a lot in common. I first met him in the early '90s, and he was talking about that very thing, that the he was calling humans a super wolf and talking about hunting, and then we got discussing fire, and I think it was a part of his perspective that was helpful to him. He does repeat photography. He looks at the historical landscape patterns. He looks at the historical record, the Lewis and Clark journals, very much the same things I look at. He tends to focus on Utah and Yellowstone and I think Banff National Park in Canada, whereas I tend to focus on Northern California and the Pacific Northwest. So we have different geographic regions. He's affiliated with a university, and I am not.
Yeah.
So those are, but he still likes to hunt and does trophy hunting, and I was never a trophy hunter. I was always a meat hunter.
Right. Well, he's at that university, Utah State or University.
Yep.
He's there under special arrangements, you know.
He's in the political science department because, like me, our fields, they go for consensus science, and that means that if you disagree, they take away your funding or they belittle your capabilities.
Right.
And that's how agency science comes up with consensus, and I don't know why they just don't call it dirty politics, but that's what it is, basically.
And that's what they've done to him. I think the legislature intervened and got him his job back and make sure he gets paid. Otherwise, he'd be the black sheep of the family there.
Well, he still is. What they do is they marginalize those of us that are actually challenging the prevailing assumptions, challenging the forest ecologists and the fire ecologists using their models. Mm-hmm. Those of us actually using documentation are marginalized.
All right. Well, everyone stay with us. I can tell already this is going to be fascinating. PhD, Bob Zybak is his name, archaeologist, historical ecologist. We'll be back.
With my banjo on my knee, and I'm bound for Louisiana, my own true love for the sea.
The nation's leading custom rifle manufacturer is without question Jarrett Rifles in Jackson, South Carolina. For 25 years, Kenny Jarrett has been producing the most accurate hunting rifles any man's money can buy. Jarrett manufactures the barrel, the action, and the stock. Jarrett Rifles are guaranteed to shoot 1/2 minute of angle groups. Wow. And Jarrett Rifles owns and operates Cowden Plantation, the South's premier deer hunting location. Check them out on the web at JarrettRifles.com. You will be impressed. Hi, folks. Let me tell you a short story. Mr. Jake Hartwick, one of the founders of the Outdoor Channel, is producing hunting videos. I recently reviewed his first DVD and declared it is destined to revolutionize how hunting films are produced. I actually got a sense of being on the hunt. Yes, folks, it's that good, and it's filmed entirely in high definition, so the video quality is amazing. Get your copy today at www.songofafricasafari.com. That's songofafricasafari.com. The Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd is a new national organization dedicated to saving one of the most famous mule deer herds in the nation. Yes, it is a critical time for mule deer in Nevada. They are rapidly disappearing with each passing year, and so is the grand tradition of mule deer hunting. This trend can be reversed, but only if you are willing to help. Nevada Department of Wildlife has all but written mule deer off and is strategically replacing native mule deer with non-native elk. They must be stopped. Mountain lions are destroying the mule deer resource, and mountain lions must be aggressively controlled. This is an unprecedented fight. Never before has a major western hunting state allowed a native game animal to fade into history while replacing it with a non-native species. Visit Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd at their new home, huntersalert.org, and get involved. Tell Nevada's Department of Wildlife it is time to bring Nevada's mule deer herd back. Starting right now. For the latest in premium deer lures, scents, and calls, go visit moorswidowmaker.com. That's moorswidowmaker.com. There you will find a variety of buck lures, cover scents, and buck calls, all carefully crafted from all natural ingredients. You can also book an exotic hunt on an island in the middle of a river. That's moorswidowmaker.com, moorswidowmaker.com, for the best in deer lures, cover scents, and maybe the hunt of a lifetime. This is Jim Slinsky. So you say to yourself, you like this show with its great guests and great topics. Well, if you're a local business, you really should consider advertising with the Outdoor Talk Network. Just call the local radio station broadcasting this program and ask for their advertising rate. Talk radio is an incredibly powerful communication medium. Advertising on talk radio stations is the best buy in the advertising industry. Talk radio listeners are unique. They listen through the advertising breaks. They don't channel surf and they are loyal. Advertise with a program that local listeners enjoy, and it will certainly benefit your business. When you compare ad rates for talk radio to print media, you will find talk radio a very cost-effective approach to growing your business. If your market is the nation, simply email me at advertising@outdoortalknetwork.com. Lastly, if you cater to outdoor enthusiasts, locally or nationally, it would only make sense to support this program so this program can continue to support you and your business.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like it.
All right, Jim Slinsky here, Outdoor Talk Network. I'm impressed with my guest already. A man that speaks his mind. Bob Zybak is his name, calling him in Oregon. Lots of issues. We do lots of shows, Bob, about Oregon and Washington, California. And you're right, they're similar, but the issues are a little bit different than the Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado type issues and so forth. And we have some common friends. Bob's highly recommended. And as you can hear, he's filling us in already. But Bob, as an archaeologist, as a historical ecologist, I want to take you back to the first segment there when we were talking a little bit about you and Charles Kay and your feelings and your views and how they differ from you know general consensus. And I want you to elaborate a little bit because I want to drive this one home. But people don't understand this. There's always like these two distinct thoughts out there, and you know, if you disagree with the mainstream, you're going to be in trouble here. And isn't that the situation we have at hand in your field?
Well, yeah, I think in lots of fields, unfortunately, one thing that we've got similar with Idaho and Montana is we've got a preponderance of federal land ownership, mm-hmm. and so the scientists that and we've got land grant universities, so the scientists that practice for the government. Basically, have to buy into a party line. It's mm-hmm. a political situation, and science is supposed to be a game of challenges. If somebody comes up with an assumption that they don't state, or they state an assumption that's flawed, you're supposed to challenge that. If they come up with a theory or a hypothesis, you're supposed to challenge it. But what we find in science today, and I think forest and fire science in particular, and in climate science as well, is that those of us that say, wait a minute, the documents don't verify the models. These mm-hmm. models are based on a lot of speculation, are typically marginalized. Our funding's removed, our credentials are questioned, our capabilities to function as scientists are
yeah, chastised and criticized and the rest of it. You get clobbered.
Or just ignored or mocked even. So
right.
These types of things have been not just for me or for Charles, but I can name other people as well. That's how society tends to marginalize the outliers. But in science, that's a really bad practice because mm-hmm. in science, it's critical to have mm-hmm. actual peer review rather than formalized peer review as we do now.
Right, right, right. And you mentioned climate issues and so forth, but I always felt, and I was always told, you know, in science, when you conduct an experiment and, you know, based on a hypothesis you have, this has to work every time. It can't work once in a while or every so often. If you want to prove that this is true, it has to work all the time, doesn't it, Bob?
Well, you've got to be able to replicate your results. I did a paper on carbon sequestration in conifer forests in 1992, and I looked at the models, and I was qualified to do it because my background was in tree farm management, and I was up on computers at that time. They're a lot simpler than they are now, not a whole lot simpler. But what I was looking at, because I used the same proxy measures that the climate people do, tree rings and carbon prisms and so on, I was looking at how good the models were at predicting the past. If they can't go backwards, there's no way they can go forward.
Of course.
Well, none of the models could predict the past. So what happens is I got my paper published, and it was peer-reviewed at an international symposium of scientists, and all my funding was dropped, and I was excluded from doing any further climate modeling or analysis, and that's how you get consensus.
Yeah. I can think of it a little off the beaten path here, but I can think of a doctor here in my home state of Pennsylvania, a Dr. William Sharp, who's been pounding away at the impacts of acid deposition from the Ohio coal burners for 30 years. And, you know, they just beat him up. And here in my home state, you know, we have some reforestation problems, but it's always the deer. There is never any other, you know, component to this reforestation problem. It's just deer, you know, and we do soil samples. We pull soil samples here, and the pH is 3.5 and 3.9. And people want to know, you know, where's the trillium? Where's the red oaks? And where are all these tree species, this herbaceous ground cover? And yet they do not and cannot declare what the you know, nutrient levels requirements are, what the pH is, and so forth. And this Dr. Sharp, he has won awards. He's won awards from certain groups, and then he is just heavily criticized and chastised by other groups. And I feel bad for him, but he's
probably doing something right if he's getting support and criticism. That's probably doing something right.
Right.
If that's the main thing, is to get some discussion and some thinking going, and to look at problems from all sides, and those are good characteristics. I think the worst thing is to be working in a vacuum and not have your work recognized one way or another. Here the problem is we're looking at wildfires. They're out of control. That's my field of specialty. And it's a fuel issue. We're letting all these forests die, get killed by bugs. We don't harvest the dead wood. The dead wood reburns. It's pitchy firewood, air-dried firewood at that point. And so people say, you know, well, we're scientists for the government. We couldn't have made a mistake, so it must be global warming.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not good science. It's bureaucracy. It's really bad politics. And it's really costly for the American people.
Yep.
And it destroys, you're talking about hunting, it destroys habitat in an instant, as well as killing
right.
wildlife.
And we always hear about protect the endangered species, and,
mm-hmm.
and we got to do this and we got to do that. Well, what are you doing when a wildfire comes through and maybe burns at, you know, 1,500 degrees and scorches the earth? Tell me about your endangered species after a fire goes through.
Ours is spotted owls here, and we had on the B&B fire, they had bug kill over 90,000 acres. Then 10 years later, the acreage burned up predictably. Everybody, myself included, were on record saying, this is going to burn up if you don't get it the heck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to a tour with the Forest Service, and Jerry Franklin was present, and they said 17 spotted owls were lost, breeding pairs were lost in this fire. And I said, well, wait a minute. Those things fly. Were they lost, or was their habitat destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out their habitat was destroyed, but to them that was the same thing as losing the birds.
Yeah. Now that is intriguing. Well, we're right against the break, and we're going to go to break and come back. Bob, I want you to tell us about the habits of the Indians, the Native Americans, and how that affected forest management. But his name is Bob Zybak. He's an archaeologist. He's a historical ecologist. I mean, he's just great stuff. And if you're listening, I'm truly impressed. We're getting some great information now. Please stay with us. We'll be back after these few brief commercials.
Tell your children not to do what I've been done.
Now don't touch that dial. You're listening to Jim Slinsky and the Outdoor Talk Network, the most unique talk show in the nation. We'll be right back. This is Jim Slinsky. So you say to yourself, you like this show with its great guests and great topics. Well, if you're a local business, you really should consider advertising with the Outdoor Talk Network. Just call the local radio station broadcasting this program and ask for their advertising rate. Talk radio is an incredibly powerful communication medium. Advertising on talk radio stations is the best buy in the advertising industry. Talk radio listeners are unique. They listen through the advertising breaks. They don't channel surf and they are loyal. Advertise with a program that local listeners enjoy, and it will certainly benefit your business. When you compare ad rates for talk radio to print media, you will find talk radio a very cost-effective approach to growing your business. If your market is the nation, simply email me at advertising@outdoortalknetwork.com. Lastly, if you cater to outdoor enthusiasts, locally or nationally, it would only make sense to support this program so this program can continue to support you and your business. For the latest in premium deer lures, scents, and calls, go visit moorswidowmaker.com. That's moorswidowmaker.com. There you will find a variety of buck lures, cover scents, and buck calls, all carefully crafted from all natural ingredients. You can also book an exotic hunt on an island in the middle of a river. That's moorswidowmaker.com, moorswidowmaker.com, for the best in deer lures, cover scents, and maybe the hunt of a lifetime. Hi, folks. Let me tell you a short story. Mr. Jake Hartwick, one of the founders of the Outdoor Channel, is producing hunting videos. I recently reviewed his first DVD and declared it is destined to revolutionize how hunting films are produced. I actually got a sense of being on the hunt. Yes, folks, it's that good, and it's filmed entirely in high definition, so the video quality is amazing. Get your copy today at www.songofafricasafari.com. That's songofafricasafari.com. The nation's leading custom rifle manufacturer is without question Jarrett Rifles in Jackson, South Carolina. For 25 years, Kenny Jarrett has been producing the most accurate hunting rifles any man's money can buy. Jarrett manufactures the barrel, the action, and the stock. Jarrett Rifles are guaranteed to shoot 1/2 minute of angle groups. Wow. And Jarrett Rifles owns and operates Cowden Plantation, the South's premier deer hunting location. Check them out on the web at JarrettRifles.com. You will be impressed. The Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd is a new national organization dedicated to saving one of the most famous mule deer herds in the nation. Yes, it is a critical time for mule deer in Nevada. They are rapidly disappearing with each passing year, and so is the grand tradition of mule deer hunting. This trend can be reversed, but only if you are willing to help. Nevada Department of Wildlife has all but written mule deer off and is strategically replacing native mule deer with non-native elk. They must be stopped. Mountain lions are destroying the mule deer resource, and mountain lions must be aggressively controlled. This is an unprecedented fight. Never before has a major western hunting state allowed a native game animal to fade into history while replacing it with a non-native species. Visit Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd at their new home, huntersalert.org, and get involved. Tell Nevada's Department of Wildlife it is time to bring Nevada's mule deer herd back. Starting right now.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got on.
Well, I can honestly say I'm very pleased to have met our guest. Bob Zybak is his name, and he's an archaeologist, a historical ecologist, deeply, deeply involved in all of these contemporary issues. And of course, you know, I not only keep my finger on the pulse of deer management in Maine, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, but forest management, elk management, mule deer management, all throughout the West, and private property issues and so forth. And Bob's a good one. Bob's telling us a lot of great stuff in new words, and I'm getting the message, Bob. I really am. I'm getting it. But let me take you back to, you know, something you said before. You mentioned Lewis and Clark and of course my association with Dr. K and you know, Valerius Geist, and there's always this confusion about, you know, what the American Indians did, how they managed the land, how many there were in the road, did they or did they not build roads, did they fight with each other, did they compete for food? But this concept of forest management comes up all the time, and you know, you've done these studies, and you know, give us your thoughts. What really happened before we got here?
Well, I think two things. One thing I want to clarify, that
go ahead.
I'm academically trained as an archaeologist, but I don't practice archaeology in the traditional sense. I'm more of a forest historian.
Go ahead.
So I really look a lot at forest history, and I use documentation. I use archaeological resources as well, but typically relict vegetation patterns rather than lithics, although lithics are helpful. That's stone type materials. So I look at forest history in relation to human activities on the landscape.
All right.
And so Indians in the Pacific Northwest are a particular focus because forest history, you go back much before Lewis and Clark, and there's no white influence here. It's, it's all 100% Indians. It's different from the East Coast, and we've that's more immediate to our past here. And so when you're talking about old growth trees, you're talking about seedlings and saplings and second growth that developed while Indians were here. And so how did they develop? Why are those patterns different than the patterns now? Yes, they had heavily developed transportation networks. One of the key things I focus on is the evolution of Indian trails to white explorer horse pack train type trails such as the beaver hunters and that, trappers, to wagon roads such as Oregon Trail, Applegate Trail, to roads and highways. And so typically they're the same routes. People live in the same spots. They live at the mouth of streams because there's fresh water, there's mobility, there's seasonal fish runs and so on. They maintain grasslands because that's what the best habitat is for deer and bear and California condors used to be. So the types of animals that people lived with worked with as far as tools and hides and meats and so on were a part of the forest environment, part of the forest history.
Sure.
You talked about deer browsing Pennsylvania trees and shrubs and causing reforestation problems. We have the same problem here with boomers and deer and elk. But the white spotted grazing animals, sheep and cattle and horses, so areas that the Indians had burnt every year to harvest tar weed or to keep areas clear of weeds, such as Douglas fir was a weed species because it shaded out oak and filberts or hazel and flowering plants that they depended upon for their livelihood.
Okay.
So the area was a vast network of trails. Canoe routes, people went out in the ocean, they had large boats, canoes that could carry 20, 30 people, several tons of storage. They could go out when the Europeans couldn't go out into the ocean. The land routes and the water routes, they didn't have horses, were a major trade routes. You can do that by looking at the lithics or the seeds or the different plants, and they had vast areas, tens of thousands of contiguous acres of tar wheat and camas and oak, which is acorns, that were maintained with regular fire.
Okay. Now, did they maintain them because they utilized it, you know, the shrubbery itself, the herbaceous growth? I mean, are they eating this like as their salad, or did they maintain that as wildlife food so they can draw wildlife, maintain wildlife, and kill wildlife so they can eat it?
It's for personal use. The same reason we have crops is the exact same reason they did. It wasn't herbaceous material they were eating so much. One thing, fuel, firewood. Manzanita is a fuel, so you're raising fuel. The other thing is food. Main subsistence was vegetation. It was camas, which thousands and thousands of acres, tens of thousands of tons were harvested a year. Grains, tarweed was roasted over thousands of acres, thousands of tons harvested every year. These crops could be made into products that stored for decades, literally decades.
All right, I'm just not familiar with camas and tarweed. That's totally new. I mean, that a Western species that exists today. Camas
existed all throughout North America. It was the most common food crop species throughout the United States prior to white immigration here.
And what is camas?
It's a blue lily. It's beautiful. They've got Camas Valley and Camas Swale and so on here, town of Camas. It grows. It's a bulb. It requires a lot of fuel to it's real starchy. So you bake it for 2 or 3 days, which requires a lot of fuel, and it turns into a heavy sugar, kind of sweet potato flavored, kind of a taffy type of texture that will literally store for years. And so it was a trade item as well as a staple, much like potatoes to the Irish or corn to the Nebraskan people.
Okay. Have you ever eaten camas? Do people still eat it today?
They don't so much, you know, but they—I think they should. It's a beautiful flower. They use a little bit for landscaping. The tribes are starting to use it again. It's a traditional food. It was a staple.
Okay.
It's just a wonderful food. Wapato is another one. It tastes—you can cook it in 10 minutes. It tastes like a sweet potato. It's very nutritious. Both of them, of course. Hazelnuts. Everybody knows about those, acorns are the same thing. They're acidic, so they've got to be leached and treated. So these things were more agrarian in nature than hunter-gatherer. People had to dig them up. They had to process them. They had to build ovens. And that's the type of job that takes weeks and months.
And you're saying this was part of their land management practice, the need for and the desire for these foods that they ate, more of an agrarian type situation. This is what led them to the land practices that they maintained?
Yes, and that's what formed the wildlife habitat that preceded white settlement, and that's the type of habitat that's being degraded through current practices of just letting these trees grow up and die and burn up and say that we're returning fire to the landscape. It's just it's a destructive myth. It's destroying our forests, and it's not historically accurate. It's not good science. It's a little bit perturbing.
Okay. Now, did you ever study or look at the influence of forestry as an industry in this whole scheme of things, Bob? I mean, you know, I can tell you what role forestry's played in the Northeast in the pursuit of hardwood dollars, you know, hardwood revenue, timber receipts for hardwoods. I mean, it completely reshaped the Northeast and parts of the South and the Midwest. And you know, was it just, you know, this is all pine and fir and stuff. Has forestry played a role in all of this, this conversion to where we are now?
Well, I'm a forest historian, so naturally I studied that too. But more than that, for 25 years, I was in reforestation. I personally planted over 2 million trees, which is harder to do here than in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And my crews did about 80,000 acres of reforestation work. So I'm intimately familiar with the forest of the Pacific Northwest. Had a lot to do with putting some of them together, and know the history very well. So yes, the key thing you have to look at is for the Indians, the most valuable crop was food crop and grazing for some of the wild animals and so on. So they were looking at solar energy to produce foods, grains, bulbs, nuts,
mm-hmm.
and to the whites though there wasn't any. Saw logs. So we like Douglas fir, the same thing that the Indians saw as a weed, we saw as a cash crop. So we started letting the forests expand the range, expand into the savannas. We started planting trees over time, letting them seed, and logging them and milling them and creating an entirely different use of the landscape with an entirely different plant.
Yeah, not at all makes sense. That all makes sense, and now we're still fighting over how to manage the land, what's best for the land, you know, where we should be, and so forth. And of course, fire, as you said before, fire becomes that focal point because of what fire does to the landscape. And you know, some people want to put everything out, some people want to let everything burn, and we still have that conflict of trying to determine what was done prior to us arriving. So, interesting.
That's why it's so critical. The Indians were much better with fire than we are. They didn't let wildfires burn up everything. I mean, what we're doing with fire, saying it's natural and it's returning to the environment, is just not true.
Bullpucky. But we'll, yes. let's go to break. We'll come back. Bob Zybak is his name, and he's a historical ecologist, a forest historian. We'll be right back.
Behind him, you might say he was born again. Might say he found the key for every door. When it first came to the mountains.
For 2009, Nikon Sport Optics continues their passion to bring you the toughest, most innovative optical gear ever. The recently completely redesigned Monarch rifle scopes with their advanced iBox technology, delivering an impressive 4x zoom range and a constant 4 inches of eye relief, has been expanded to include new models. Nikon's Omega 250 BDC bullet drop compensating muzzle loading scopes and their Slug Hunter BDC 200 have become classics, now available in new power ranges. With the new laser rangefinders designed specifically for bow hunting, titanium scopes, handgun scopes, Buckmasters and Pro Staff scopes, 16 different binocular lines, and premium spotting scopes, you can see why Nikon has something for every hunter and every hunting style. And completely new for this year are their Coyote Special rifle scopes in camo with anti-reflective designs and a patent-pending predator hunting reticle. Check out a Nikon rifle scope today and see why experienced hunters choose Nikon. Hunting is no longer just how to and where to. Hunting has become a will it continue situation. NRAHuntersRights.org is the best place to keep up with the escalating threats to hunting and NRA's efforts to combat them. NRA works to increase hunter access on public lands, keep shooting ranges open, recruit new hunters, and defeat the growing tide of animal rights extremists and anti-hunting groups. At NRAHuntersRights.org, you will also find forums to express your opinion on critical hunting issues, a trophy gallery to post photos of your downed game, a state-by-state index of public hunting lands, and a monthly gift giveaway where you might win guns, optics, knives, and other gear. You might even find a column or two by yours truly. NRA, defending your freedom to hunt. Visit www.nrahuntersrights.org and get involved. The future of your right to hunt depends on you. Why join the Hunting Channel? Aside from having all the best shows on TV available to you 24/7 and my radio show anywhere, anytime, receive instant discounts on gear, hunting guides, outfitters, and much, much more. How about access to tips from professional hunters, up-to-date articles, and gear reviews? With just the discounts alone, most members will recoup their membership fee with their first gear purchase or their first hunt. Think about it. Go on a $4,500 elk hunt in Colorado and get a 10% discount with the outfitter. That's $450 saved. Or buy an $800 rifle and scope or bow and save $80. These savings are easily worth $24.95 a year, plus all the other useful information available after becoming a member. Go to their website at www.thehuntingchannelonline.com and join today. If you use promo code OTN, you will get 4 months free. That's promo code OTN and start saving now. All right, we're back. Jim Selinsky here, Outdoor Talk Network. I am impressed. Bob Zybak is his name. I am impressed. He is a forest historian and a historical ecologist. We're talking about land management and tree management, fires, suppression or not suppression. You caught me off guard here, Bob. I mean, I haven't heard, you know, the majority of what you told us during this show. I have not heard in over 1,000 shows. I have not had it explained in quite the manner that you're putting your words together, and it really is intriguing. But let's go back to what you said in a previous segment. I asked you if you know, the Indians, the American Indians, if their method and purpose for managing the land was different. And of course, when we had settlement here, Western European settlement, everything came about trees. Of course, we needed the trees to build. We didn't live in teepees. You know, the settlers didn't live in teepees. They wanted to build. So we needed wood. So the whole focal point changed, and that impacted our land management. Is that all fairly accurate?
Yeah. First, I want to compliment you on your music. I appreciate that you played Dylan and Roy Orbison. Not so sure about the Denver tune, but
I told you the Denver tune was a mistake. I mean, the disc shifted on me. So
yep. So. I just listened to Dylan a couple nights ago, so that was all reassuring stuff.
All right. Good. I'm glad to hear that. No, I'm a music buff myself. Makes me smile, makes me happy.
Yeah, so. Williams, Hank Williams, that's right back to my childhood. But
right.
The deal is, Indians did not have teepees out here. People think they had horses and teepees. They actually lived in plank homes, very similar in many ways to, say, Swiss chalets.
Okay.
20 or 30 people lived in a home. Some of these homes were 300 feet long. Lewis and Clark found houses that were probably 400 and 500 years old. So they used a lot of planks, but they used cedar rather than Douglas fir. Douglas fir was pitchy and it was more of a secondary wood. It was used for pitch, for caulking canoes. It was used for firewood, for open fires, not for baking because it's too pitchy for the food. The key difference is that the Indians used prescribed fire, not wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
They set the fires on purpose over large expanses of the landscape. Tarweed was an annual plant, so it was burnt every year. Tens of thousands of acres burnt every single year. That doesn't allow woody plants to develop.
Okay.
Roses and poison oak, filberts, those kinds of plants cannot live with fire every single year. So what you end up with, there are a lot of bulbs that you dig up out of the ground, so there's tilling, and you get bare dirt over areas, but a lot of these bulb plants take 4 and 5 and 6 years to mature, so the whole landscape wasn't tilled up. The other areas, long riparian areas, now we've got it where people aren't supposed to go along creeks, and you're supposed to have a bunch of native vegetation, usually a lot of weeds, a lot of blackberry and stuff like that develop, because we're supposed to have a naturally functioning ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
which somehow doesn't have people in it, which seems unnatural and historically is unnatural.
Okay.
But what really, for 10,000 years and longer, people did it just like they do now. They go up and down the river, they're fishing it, they're bathing in it, they're getting fresh water out of it, they're fishing firewood out of it. They don't have structure in the streams. It's firewood. It's got a value. It's like leaving cans of gasoline laying around the park. People would pick it up and use it.
Okay.
So it was basically a lot of this dead wood they've got out there that's causing wildfire problems and problems with prescribed burning now wasn't part of the environment.
Right.
Wasn't part of the environment for thousands of years. Dead trees weren't part of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
They were either, if people didn't take them apart and use them for firewood, bears tore them apart to eat the insects.
Yeah, they got the bugs and the grubs and the rest of it.
Yeah.
Well, that is now in your studies as a forest, you know, ecologist and so forth, how far back can you go? Because how far back did you go? A lot of this stuff gets foggy. You know, our association, our knowledge and what we hear over and over and over again really starts about 1500 or 1600 and how the white settlers interacted with the Native American Indians at that time that they both interfaced. We don't know very much, or maybe you can shed some light on, you know, how long were these policies, these practices, land management practices by the American Indians, how long were they here? How long were they doing it for 10,000 years or 12,000 years? How long was it going on? Or did it develop over that period of time?
Well, that's an excellent question. And one thing on the East Coast there, I've got my relations there go back to the 1600s, and you're right, that's where the first records are. But on the West Coast, the first records are really not much before Lewis and Clark. There's, you know, Robert Gray here in 1788, and a few records, a few Russian visitors that didn't leave much in the way of written records, maybe some Chinese or Japanese. It's very speculative. But the records here, I've talked to third generation people that are just going back and telling their grandparents stories of some of the very first encounters between Indians and whites. So I'm co-authoring a piece right now on the Coquille Indian history with a man whose great-grandfather was pure Indian and could remember Jedediah Smith, one of the first whites in 1828 coming through the Coos County. And his grandfather from the early 1850s had the first sawmill in town and married an Indian woman. And so his father knew stories second and third hand going back to the very first encounters. So our history here is a lot more recent.
Right.
That being said, history has got two definitions. One is written, so when usually the white male comes in and starts writing things, the women didn't, and other races for the most part didn't. That's what we call history. So it's a very culturally sexist because it's male, mm-hmm. racist because it's white perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call history. So we look at wars and football games and stuff. We don't look at what the Indian women were doing, which was burning the area and digging crops and preparing foods and cooking different recipes.
Mm-hmm.
We tend not to look at that stuff. But that's what kept people going. So 10 and 12,000 years ago, that's where my research starts, because before then there was really a sheet of ice that was covering much of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And as the ice melted, there were people here.
Mm-hmm.
So people are always on the edge of a glacier for lots of different reasons. And so you got footprints, literally, on the land before you have your first forest trees.
Okay.
So people are preceding the forest, not in the south so much or the southern United States. There's more of a migration of plants and immigration of people there. But through the Pacific Northwest area I deal with, most of Washington state was covered with ice, and the Willamette Valley in western Oregon flooded regularly with a 400-foot wall of water that kind of flushed everything clean. So you have people and forests developing simultaneously. Now, people are using fire from day one. We know that from the archaeological record, and we just know that from common sense. They cook lunch every day. They stay warm at night. They want light in the dark. And so every day they're burning a fire. So every time you got an east wind here, which is a drying wind, but south of here it's a south wind, and Santa Ana's and so on, sparks fly from these fires. They hit the landscape. If you got fuels, fire goes uphill. And so it doesn't take a large amount of people to really affect the entire landscape with fire.
Wow.
And then you have regular fire, because fire is a source of ignition every day. We got people now saying, well, lightning strikes are natural. It's bunk.
Mm-hmm.
Human fires systematically spaced all across the landscape constantly are what's natural. You have a constant source of ignition. It's not a occasional lightning strike, which are kind of predictable too. Seasonally and locations of lightning strikes are pretty predictable, but people are really predictable.
Okay.
We always have fire.
Yeah. No, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. And really, with the retreat of the glaciers in 12,000 years, that's really the beginning of habitation and wildlife and everything else for the North American continent, isn't it, Bob? That's
yep.
The beginning of it all. And you go from that 12,000 year mark to the present to really as your scope of study.
12 to 15,000 years ago, and then you have the megafauna, and Charles Kay can tell you lots about this, but you got the elephants and the saber-toothed tigers and the giant sloths and giant beavers and so on are all getting killed off systematically by people, probably. We say mm-hmm. it's climate change, but that's just like we say that wildfires are caused by climate change. That's the easy answer, and it doesn't appear to be very accurate.
Right, so they were getting killed off by those first settlers, those first inhabitants of the North American continent. They were...
they might not have been the first inhabitants, but they were getting all killed off about the same time towards the end of the Ice Age, and that's probably when the population of people started going up, and the population of Indians was probably significantly greater, millions of people more than is typically assumed. And so a lot of the areas in the South and in the Pacific Northwest and so on were actually heavily populated 500 and 600 years ago, until we got the importation of diseases and systematic hunting and killing of people as well,
right.
But mostly the diseases that just really decimated the North American population.
Right. Well, I had Dr. Randy Simmons on from Utah State University or so, and his estimates were, you know, 125 million, 150 million. He was talking some pretty big numbers here until disease, until explorers came and disease set in. But Bob Zybak, I got to thank you tremendously. You were fascinating. You're welcome to come back and do another show with me. I learned a tremendous amount. Best of luck in every way. Bob, thanks for doing the show.
Thank you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening. Once again, dedicate the show to my father, as I always do. God bless him. His hunting and fishing plans always included me. See you then.